Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Divine Storm by Michael Anderley, narrated by Emily Beresford. Chapter 1. Barrow Company Dig Number 6, Kitmuller, Denmark, Wednesday, Autumn. Mads Jostad rented the motorcycle, not to save money, but for the fun of it. Harris Barrow had made it clear he would prefer Mads took an armored vehicle from the private jet that had touched down in Copenhagen all the way to Kitmuller, but the idea of being stuck in one of those clunky things was repellent. There were only so many black SUVs with tinted windows one could roll around in before the entire experience tasted bland. The Triumph Bonneville Speedmaster was a new thrill for Mads. Once he got out of Copenhagen, he opened up the throttle and let himself feel the road. Mads wondered if he would ever get to do something as simple as enjoy a motorcycle ride on the company dime again. Since Tara Olsen and Leif Freyason had joined Barrow's workforce, life had become complicated. Plenty of people were interested in antiquities. Otherwise, Harris Barrow would not have lived in a large mansion built into an Icelandic cliff with his own staff to cook, clean, and care for the place. There was money in the past, always had been. Until recently, however, no one had been willing to kill for it. Yet everything changed after Tara discovered a piece of Freya, the Norse goddess of beauty and wisdom, in a cave in Iceland. These days, people were as likely to shoot at you in an attempt to procure an antiquity as to offer a decent price at auction. Too bad for all of them that Mads had been willing to fire back. Even now, with nothing but a backpack and a duffel strapped to the Speedmaster, he was packing heat. It was one of the reasons Barrow insisted he fly privately. However, the old archaeologist primarily wanted him to use the jet to fly back as soon as Mads got his hands on the latest Freya artifact the team had discovered. Mads didn't know if he would oblige the old man. 3 hours in, his decision to take a motorcycle from Copenhagen to Kitmuller was starting to chafe. He didn't see why he couldn't get the artifact, stop at a hotel for the night, and return to the jet in the morning. Not long ago, that would not have been an option, but Barrow's team had been successful against those who opposed them. They had beaten Barrow's longtime rival, despite her acquiring an honest-to-God magic wand.
"Honest-to-gods," Mads corrected himself.
Now that he knew the Norse pantheon was real, it made cursing a different sort of enterprise. They had also faced off against Fenrir, a wolf the size of a mountain who had taken a human form and employed a henchman who used a magic ring to change shape. And they'd come out alive. That would not have happened if Thor himself hadn't shown up to tip the scales in their favor. But the simple truth was that a god had appeared to stop Fenrir. That calmed Mads in a way. It was like knowing the police were out there doing their jobs. One might think someone in his line of work wouldn't like the cosmic equivalent of the police, but Mads thought they had their place. He was a professional thief. He had been ever since he graduated from amateur. He was careful to escape the notice of the police in whatever country he was working in. If he caused enough of a splash to gain the cops' attention, he'd done something wrong. Lately, this was exactly what had been happening to their team. Beatrice had not merited a direct godly intervention. She had a piece of one, Loki's wand, the name of which Mads could not remember to save his life. They had defeated her, and afterward, Freya and Odin both revealed they had been watching closely. Then, Fenrir had drawn Thor to actually fight in Midgard. Mads felt they'd hit a sweet spot. Beatrice had hired out all the Earthbound thugs, and Mads had personally put a bullet through most of them. The foes that were too powerful for them to handle pulled Asgard's attention. Now that they were all defeated, it seemed like their team was finally entering calmer seas. Hence the motorcycle. The Barrow Company currently operated 8 digs, a huge number in this line of work. Most were dead ends, but to Mads's surprise and Barrow's delight, the head of operations here in Denmark had found an anachronistic statue hidden deep inside a cave outside Kitmuller. He had first reported it as a potential hoax, not realizing it fit a pattern the Barrow team had kept secret. All the pieces of Freya they'd located were in caves near marble statues carved with amazing detail that far surpassed what her Viking worshippers were known for. When Baro heard a dig had found another of the larger-than-life statues, he immediately sent Mads out. By the time Mads landed, the team had even recovered the box hidden inside the chamber. Baro told the head of archaeology they were interested in the site as potentially being used over multiple centuries and wished to study how the various layers of habitation had interacted and blah, blah, blah. That part of the job didn't interest Mads. He was here to get the box and bring it back to Iceland so Tara, Leif, and Harris Baro could crack it open. That meant riding a private jet and a motorcycle, not digging through the muck. The chill of autumn in the north cut through him as he finally reached Kitmöller. He was definitely going to spend the night. He didn't want to ride back to Copenhagen in the cold. He had looked online and found a few decent-looking spots for dinner. He would check with the head of the dig for recommendations. He reached the dig and dismounted his motorcycle, putting his helmet on the seat and his gloves in his pocket. He didn't bother to remove the keys from the ignition. There was nothing dangerous out here. The dig lay outside Kitmöller, between a national park and an area of low lakes and bogs. Mads didn't know why the ancient Vikings had decided to venerate Freya here, but he supposed all the better, warmer land in the south was too densely occupied. Better to raid those balmy places than actually live there, seemed to be the ancient thinking. Mads grabbed his duffel. He wanted to retrieve the box and get back on the bike quickly. No fun in being this far away from an actual city. However, the dig site had become a sort of town of its own. They had a pair of guards, one near the cave and the other trying to stay awake while overseeing a team working at a table with some fancy-looking camera. Mads always noticed security people first. Besides the guards, five others were visible. Two at the table with the camera, two carrying bags out from under a tent, and one coming toward him.
Mr. Jostad, good afternoon. You made good time.
A woman with a shock of white hair and tight wrinkles from years spent out in the elements greeted him as he approached the tent set up over the mouth of a cave.
You must be Professor Sorensen.
Mads stuck out his hand to shake.
Yes, but please call me Olivia.
Only if you call me Mads. Mr. Jostad was my father.
That wasn't strictly true, but it got the bland smile and obligatory laugh it normally did.
Of course, Mads. None of us wish to become our parents, do we?
I would think an archaeologist would be interested in their family's past.
Olivia chuckled.
You sound like my father. I grew up thinking only of the future, yet here I am, obsessed with the past. It would have been nice if he'd lived to see it.
He was an archaeologist?
Mads asked. He didn't mind the small talk.
Not at all. A religious man, devoted to some of the older beliefs in the area. Pre-Christian, if you can believe that.
Mads took a turn at the polite chuckle.
Sometimes I find the old Norse beliefs more compelling than what came after. Harder hitting.
Olivia appraised him before breaking out in a smile.
You didn't come all this way to hear a woman speak of old beliefs. You wish to see the altar? It is quite unusual.
I suppose so, yes. You said you also discovered a box there?
Yes, and I think it confirms Dr. Burrow's hypothesis that this place was used over centuries. The box is hardly weathered. More traditional-looking than the statue, though. It really is remarkable. Whoever was able to put such distress into her face was quite talented. Then to hide it under this muck? It took us a week merely to clean away the dirt clogging the entrance.
She's distressed?
Mads asked. That was odd. Certainly different. The other statues showed Freya in poses of triumph, positions of power. This one had her looking upset?
It's as if she cannot decide whether to cry or shout in rage. It feels far more modern than anything I've seen. Almost like a contemporary reaction to ancient sculpture. The art historian I showed thought the same thing.
You showed an art historian? I thought it was clear we didn't want this to get out.
He won't tell anyone. He's an old friend.
At that moment, a white van pulled up and a camera crew climbed out.
Won't tell anyone, huh?
I didn't tell a soul besides my friend.
And you got him to sign an NDA?
Not exactly.
But you mentioned how important discretion was?
I did not think a hoax needed to stay hidden. The more people wonder about these things, the more dangerous they become. Better to have it all out in the open.
The pair of guards looked anxiously from Mads to the camera crew. They knew he was the boss, but didn't know his policy on the media, likely because Mads and the van had shown up at nearly the same time. Mads wondered if they had been waiting for someone to pull up so they could piggyback in, the vultures. Either that, or Sorensen was lying, knew they were coming, and had told the guards. He would have to get rid of the media, though.
That's not the policy of the Borough Company. Now, if you'll excuse me, I need to chase off the camera crew. When I get back, I want to see that box. If they get it on video, consider your employment terminated.
Mads dropped his duffel, put on his grumpiest expression, and marched toward the white van. They waved optimistically until he cut into them for trespassing, tampering, and a few other words he'd heard Borough use when he was frustrated. Legal threats cut off any questions, and they packed their gear back up. Mads left them, picked up his bag, and returned to the task at hand. He needed to get the artifact out of here. He had no doubt other people knew how unusual this dig was by now. Before anyone decided to act on it, he wanted to be on a plane heading back to Iceland.
"I apologize, Mr. Jostad," the archaeologist told him.
"It's fine. They understand it's not a big enough story for them to bother,"
Mads stated, hoping it was true.
"Now, Professor Sorensen, if you would show me the box."
"Of course, sir,"
she muttered, and led him toward the cave. Stones stacked into a frame lined the entrance, with a massive one across the top, so large it looked as if someone with the strength of a giant must have moved it. A year ago, Mads would have guessed they'd used pulleys. Now, he couldn't help but wonder if someone had simply borrowed a belt to give them superhuman strength. Such things weren't fantasy, after all. He stepped through the stacked stone doorway into a cozy cave entrance. One more worker was in here, taking pictures of the doorframe. Archaeologists could be thrilled by the smallest of details. However, something was odd about this place. Mads couldn't say why at first, but it struck him as different than the locations of the other artifacts.
"You'll notice this room was hollowed out. There's evidence of iron tools being used," Sorensen revealed.
That was it. No stalactites, no flowing tunnels, no stones growing from the ground.
"The Vikings dug this out, then?"
"That is our current assumption, though again, considering the obvious issues with the statue, it's possible someone else dug it much later. Right this way. The box is still in the original room."
"Seems like a lot of trouble," Mads muttered.
Then his gaze fell upon the statue, and his breath caught. The pain it invoked, the despair. It was beyond words. So much emotion in her expression, her hands, her arms, her shoulders. Even the toes of one foot were twisted in agony. The statue was out of place because it was hiding a goddess's magical artifact. It wasn't fake, but completely out of this world. Not that Mads could tell the professor that.
"Faith is an amazing force," Sorensen remarked, admiring the anguished piece of marble. "People built temples that took generations to complete. I don't think it's far-fetched to imagine someone trying to make something to inspire the imagination, even if it doesn't fit the timeline."
"So you think it's a hoax, but you're still inspired by it?"
The archaeologist nodded.
"No matter when it was carved, the statue is beautiful. Whoever built this place was clever, too. We couldn't even move the box until we figured out a riddle. That's not true of any other Viking hordes."
Mads could think of a few places that fit the bill, but he wasn't about to share those specifics.
"So you solved the riddle?"
Borough had sent him here to retrieve the box, not figure out how to take it with him. He hadn't realized it was locked in place like some of the others had been.
"It was simple enough. There are runes hidden around the base of the statue. It took a few attempts, but we put them together and made a clue. What river flows over gold and tastes of creamy salt meadows? It's more elegant in the original language. We put in the answer by touching some of the runes, and the box came free."
Mads was only half listening. He couldn't tear his gaze from the statue's face. There was so much there. She looked as if she'd been betrayed, as if her hope had been ripped from her chest. His attention snapped back to the conversation when Sorensen finally produced the box. Clearly, it went with the others. It had the same red gold worked into the runes, the same elegant clasps. The only odd thing was the three locks on it across the front.
"Didn't take a pry bar to those?"
Mads asked, putting down his bag and reaching for the box. But Sorensen pulled it away. Sorensen might have played loose regarding media security, but she obviously took her archaeology seriously because she gasped at the suggestion.
"Absolutely not! We would never risk damaging such a precious artifact!"
"No diggers who used to be locksmiths on the staff, then?"
"Of course not!"
Mads reached for the box again, curious about the locks, but Sorensen pulled it away.
"You know that's not yours, right?"
he told her.
"Borrow sent me to bring it back to his team for analysis."
"That's all well and good, but I cannot imagine Mr. Borrow wanting to examine the damage that the oil from your hands did to it."
Mads gritted his teeth and pulled his gloves from his pocket.
"You wore those on the motorcycle?"
Sorensen was skeptical.
"They're calf leather. Won't scratch the box, I promise. More environmentally friendly than the disposables."
Sorensen seemed miffed at the insinuation that she did not care about the environment, but she finally handed it over. Mads considered pulling out his set of lockpicks and going to work. There was a good chance it needed some magical mumbo-jumbo to open, but the look on Sorensen's face when he attacked the locks with his picks might be worth it. He resisted the urge. Instead, he examined the box from all angles, then carefully wrapped it in a piece of cloth and stowed it in his bag next to a disassembled rifle and a handgun.
"Dr. Borrow will open it, then?"
Sorensen asked. Her curiosity was palpable.
"Oh, he's got a team just for that. They'll find a way in."
"I can't wait to see what's inside,"
Sorensen remarked.
"We'll be in touch, of course. I'm sure you'll find the continued exploration of the past fascinating, and your contributions are greatly appreciated."
Mads trailed off. Some archaeologists didn't like the boilerplate, "Thank you for your time, now buzz off" message. But Sorensen wasn't paying attention. She was looking toward the entrance.
"Someone is shouting," she mumbled.
"It's those damn camera crews. I told you to keep a tighter lid on things."
Then he heard something that did not sound like it came from any hoax-chasing camera crew. It sounded like gunshots.
"You weren't expecting hunters in the area, were you?"
"Not at all."
"I didn't think so."
Mads pulled his handgun from his duffel.
"Stay here. I'll be back. We can't lose this artifact to them."
"To whom?"
Sorensen was clearly freaking out.
"To whoever found out about this place, thanks to your little game of telephone."
Mads went to the cave entrance and found one of the guards crouched behind cover. The man clutched a handgun, but looked so sweaty that he might drop it.
"What's going on out there?"
"I don't know. They just started shooting."
"Did anyone get hurt?"
"I don't know."
"New job?"
"I used to be a mailman."
"Sit tight, mate. We'll get through this. You all drove here, yeah?"
"In a van together, yes."
"Then the goal is we all get out."
"How do we do that?"
"First, we need to know what we're dealing with."
Mads peeked out from behind the stacked stone doorway. He ducked back a half second later.
"Looks like six attackers, all dressed in black and armed more heavily than we are. Does a crow mean anything to you? That a gang symbol around here or something?"
"A crow?
A raven, then? I don't know, a blackbird?"
The attackers wore black hoods pulled over their faces and black sashes around their foreheads with a bird in the center. Also black, but outlined in white. The guard only shrugged. With another glance, Mads saw the second guard had ordered the four workers outside the cave to the van. He was braced behind the van now, aiming at the approaching team of hostiles dressed in black, except for the bird thing. At least one of the security team had experience, though maybe not the courage to open fire on six people packing weapons. Mads would have to do that part. He popped out of cover and fired four shots, two at one of the approaching bird bandits, then two more that went wide. That was fine, though. He'd hit the first man in the chest and discovered this team had bulletproof gear. The hostile was down, likely feeling the blast, but not dead. That meant Mads had to aim for heads or limbs if he wanted his shots to count.
And to think, this morning I was almost bored, Mads muttered to the guard. You're enjoying this?
The guard was flummoxed.
Mads grinned. I guess I am. I need you to shoot at them while I get Sorensen and that last digger to the van. I don't think I can hit them. You don't have to, mate. Only let them know if they try to come any closer. They're risking a bullet to the face. Right. On my mark.
The guard had already spent all his courage. He popped up and started firing.
Sorensen, get your people in the van and drive out of here.
Sorensen was wide-eyed and more than happy to follow the order to flee. She grabbed her other digger and ran out, looking back at the duffel with the box in it only once.
Don't worry, I'm not going to forget about that, Mads assured her.
Sorensen nodded as she and the other digger took cover behind the van and started getting everyone inside. The second guard fired a few shots. The guard with Mads had already expended his magazine and was trying to reload with a shaking hand.
I want you to run for the van too, all right? On my mark. Sure.
The guard didn't wait. He ran for the van and promptly took a bullet to an ass cheek.
Oh, come on. Not what I needed.
Mads cursed, squeezed off a few shots, then broke cover to help the guard. Adrenaline helped the guard deal with the pain. Mads helped him reach the van, told him to put something on the wound to stop the bleeding, and insisted they all get out of there. They obeyed, leaving Mads alone with five attackers. And he had left his duffel in the cave. The birdie bandits shot at him, and he didn't turn back. Instead, he ran for his motorcycle as the attackers pressed on for the cave. A few more shots flew at his backside, but he could tell they were only trying to scare him now. If they wanted to hit him, they could have. He jumped onto the motorcycle, turned the engine on, and revved it. He thanked the powers that be he'd sprung for the insurance, and actually checked the tread on the tires. Then, he accelerated toward the cave. He fired his handgun as he went, enacting a fantasy he'd had for years, but never wanted to act out. His aim was terrible while driving, but that wasn't the point. The attackers dove for the ground as Mads reached the entrance, then turned the bike around, kicking up mud. He dismounted and ran inside, then threw the duffel over one shoulder. He wanted to assemble the rifle, but didn't think he had time. He was right. When he got back to the doorway, one of the hostiles had made it there. So, Mads shot him in the thigh. The hooded figure collapsed, screaming in pain. Mads reloaded his handgun, fired a few more warning shots, and ran for his motorcycle. He got on, revved the engine, and churned up a nearby hill. He crested the rise to find a van hidden over the ridge. It almost looked like a news van, but not quite. Mads fired at the tires and managed to hit two of them. A lucky thing. If he could get away from here, he might actually live. He was about to pull away when another figure stepped from behind the van. He was dressed oddly. Not in black, but in a nice suit with a wide-brimmed hat pulled over his eyes. Mads felt he knew the man, but wasn't about to introduce himself. Instead, he gunned the engine and headed back for the road before the other four bandits decided to actually aim. Now, Mads had no choice but to drive directly back to the airport and hope no one followed him. He glanced back once. With two flat tires, the attackers were not pursuing. Fortunately, the archaeological team had already reached the main road safely. They would lose the dig site, though. If the attackers chose to paw through it, destroy it, or do anything else, Mads couldn't stop them.
So much for an easy trip.
Chapter 2. Freyjastone, Reykjavik, Iceland, 2 days later. Tara stepped into her home, still shocked to be thinking in such terms. It did not help that Barrow had a sign made and hung above the door that said, Freya's Stone. How was she living in a place named after a goddess? She was an insurance adjuster from Cincinnati. Or she had been. Now she was the mortal heir to the power of said goddess, and best friends with her great-great-grandson.
Well, that looks lovely, doesn't it?
Leif looked up at the sign and smiled. You don't think it's a little much? Tara asked.
Compared to the rest of this place? Hardly. In Asgard, practically every building has a name. So does every tree, for that matter. I can think of at least a dozen stones called Freya's Stone there. This is nicer than all of them.
Somehow I doubt that, Tara muttered. The house was a modest one-story with three bedrooms, two baths, and a kitchen in need of an update. The outside was painted white. It had a driveway in the front and a tiny yard landscaped with various shrubs and stubby trees. The only thing that made it feel Icelandic instead of American to Tara was the sauna built onto the back of the house. Not that they had a chance to use it yet. They'd just returned from another unsuccessful dig.
You humans are capable of adapting to such wonders. This house is a thing of beauty. If only you could see it. The window glass is so exquisitely free of air bubbles that on Asgard, we would have assumed dwarves made them. Here, you expect windows to look like that. There is a hearth, but you do not need to actually use it. You have some hidden device to provide heat when needed.
Yeah, but there's no air conditioning, Tara complained, and cracked a window in the living room in the front of the house.
Another wonder you all take for granted. Then there's all this steel, casually kept in kitchen drawers. You understand the Vikings would sail hundreds of miles for a hoard like this? Those who could keep their blades sharpest were regarded as powerful warriors. Now, on Midgard, you have blades for chopping onions as sharp as any sword was back then.
I don't know. I think Viking swords are cooler than kitchen knives, Tara mentioned. They'd found a stash of five swords on their most recent dig, and a few axes, bits of jewelry, and coins. It was a success by any metric, yet Tara could not help but feel disappointed. She'd thought the dig would be their next breakthrough, but they hadn't found any of Freya's artifacts or a clue where the next one might be.
They do seem to captivate the imagination of the people of this era, though I didn't see many for sale when I went around Gothenburg.
Of course not. People don't need swords anymore. They belong in museums.
See? Yet another modern wonder. So many people in this world, all able to share without stabbing each other. Maybe that's why your kitchens have so many blades. Better to release that frustration on a potato than a fellow human.
I don't think we're quite there yet.
Well, no. Spending my time with you has exposed me to the people of this world who would hurt others. But that's a small fraction, is it not? When I was in Gothenburg, most people were quite polite.
That's because you wrapped yourself in blue and gold.
Everyone had blue and gold. It's a fetching combination.
Leif tossed his scarf around his neck. He hadn't taken it off. The fall weather was cool, and the stuffy house hadn't warmed up yet. Tara chuckled. Because those are Swedish colors. If you wear them around here, you won't get as many smiles.
Ah, but I won't get stabbed, will I?
Probably not. However, considering we want to keep a low profile, it might be better to get another scarf. Or at least carry a kitchen knife, I suppose. Leif laughed.
I'm not sure if those have the reach someone of my stature would require. But I suppose I will arm myself, and we shall see.
Leif only took a single step into the kitchen before he yelped. Tara didn't know the house's layout well enough to teleport into the other room, so she ran to Leif's aid, letting the Sather in the bracers she almost always wore invigorate her. She'd hoped they had kept a low enough profile to avoid notice in their new home, but apparently not. She didn't want to destroy another property Barrow had procured for them, especially one that felt so much like a home. But she wouldn't let anyone hurt her friends. When she burst into the kitchen, she found not an enemy, but a friend.
Who were you expecting? Fenrir?
Mads asked. He had a plate of eggs and toast in front of him, half eaten. What are you doing here? Tara demanded. Mads shrugged.
Thought it was obvious. Eating some eggs and toast. She means, why are you in our house when you know we are being pursued by foes on all fronts? Doesn't look that way to me at the moment,
Mads remarked.
I'd say you two look pretty relaxed compared to what I've been through getting here. Don't change the subject. With all these modern contrivances, the least you can do is contact us before you let yourself in. Do the locks even still work?
Leif demanded.
Of course I do. For one, if I was going to break into your house, I wouldn't have broken the lock. I'm a professional. Number two, you gave me a key, remember?
We did? I don't remember that. Tara looked at Leif, who only shrugged.
You asked me to make copies when you changed the locks.
Yeah, and I remember telling you to put the spare anywhere.
Right, so I put it in my pocket.
That's not what I meant, and you know it.
Mads grinned roguishly. If I didn't have that key, I would have had to wait outside for who knows how long with this.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?